Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Are your wiper blades chattering, skipping, or squeaking? Don't let streaks or smearing on your windshield compromise your visibility. When it's time to replace your wiper blades, stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and see our selection. Our professional parts people will even install your new wiper blades while you wait. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
46% of Americans expect to leave behind financial obligations when they pass away, so it's crucial to make sure your family is financially protected. Policy Genius helps you find the right life insurance coverage by comparing options from America's top insurers with help from licensed, award-winning agents. Secure your financial future with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get free life insurance quotes in just a few clicks. That's policygenius.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode number 9 of The Hunting Collective. I'm Ben O'Brien. And this week we are joined by none other than Jesse Griffiths. He's the owner of Die Dewey Butcher Shop and Supper Club here in Austin, Texas. The author of a book called A Field, A Chef's Guide to Preparing and Cooking Wild Game. That is absolutely one of the best field guides you'll ever pick up. It's more than a recipe book. It's more than a book to learn about how to cut up meat. It is, quite frankly, a coffee table book for anybody who eats meat. So, before I go any further, I will tell you that what first drew me to Jesse was that book. I have it. It's amongst the must reads in my house. I flip through it every time I'm thinking of a recipe or I'm thinking of something I need to do in the kitchen. And Jesse is always have the answer in that book. I also want to connect with him just about his ideas around food and how we find it. Jesse's Supper Club here in Austin, Texas is all locally sourced. When I say locally sourced, I mean everything from the salt to the garlic to the lemons to the limes to the meat to the vegetables is all sourced locally, grown or killed locally in the region of Texas where we are located. So he's got a lot to say about that. He's got a lot to say about why we go hunting, why he goes hunting, and he's also a guy who takes non-hunters out into the woods. They shoot hogs, and he teaches them how to butcher the entire thing. So we learned a lot in this conversation. I really enjoyed connecting with Jesse. He's an interesting guy, a down-home dude with a lot of great insights, and I enjoyed it. So without further ado, Jesse Griffiths, episode number 9. All right, Jesse Griffiths, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're here in the Yeti flagship. We're going to do it outside to be really authentic here in Austin, but it was windy, so we're
pretty windy.
Stuck in a green room drinking beer or canned wine in your case.
In my case.
So Austin, Texas, you're a business owner, restaurateur, have a lot of history here. You were telling me 1998 is when you first came to town.
Yeah.
What was it like when you first got here?
In my perspective at the time, I was just a line cook, you know, looking for work. And Austin had that glow. You know, I came from North Texas and I just thought this was the coolest town. And I mean, obviously I stayed here, so there's something going. But, you know, I got down here, I really liked it. I was able to, you know, fish in any direction on my days off. And I think that really sealed the deal, being able to go to the hill country or go up to, you know, big reservoirs or anything. There's just endless places to go out here. And so I stayed.
Well, I mean, you have a restaurant here that's becoming pretty famous, Die Dewey.
Yeah.
And I guess that spins right into how you do things over there. I mean, you take ingredients from the region and build pretty fantastic dishes from what I've my experience.
Well, thank you.
What do you feel like is unique about this place?
About the region?
Yeah, the region culinary-wise. What's...
I think it's kind of a sleeper. You know, we always compare it to Northern California, where the modern theory of local sourcing started. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, local sourcing is quite possibly the oldest concept known to man, maybe the second oldest.
Yeah,
and of just eating food that comes from around where you live. And so, but it was popularized in, you know, the 70s and 80s and the Berkeley and San Francisco, and they really kind of pushed it home. And I think the ideal of being able to do that in Central Texas, it looks pretty bleak here sometimes. But if you travel in 3 hours in any direction, you've got so many options. You've got the Gulf to the east, you've got the Hill Country to the west, up north is Blackland Prairie. There's dairy farms, lots of agriculture up there. And then you go south for 3 hours and they're growing mangoes.
Yeah.
And so really we're kind of at the epicenter of this really kind of beautiful part of the world. It's a bit hot. The weather is, a bit inconsistent. I know everybody thinks that their weather's crazy, but everybody else is wrong.
Yeah.
When we were just sitting out there on the porch, the wind was like a hard east wind, and then it was a hard west wind, and it never can make up its mind down here. Yeah. It's a drought, and the way we get out of a drought is always the same way. It's a flood.
Floods. Yes. Yeah. I've been here 3 years, and like, is it gonna? When's the thunderstorm season start? When is it?
Yeah. When are you gonna get pounded? Typically January through December.
Yeah, we've been getting it the last couple of months, but see. Like, you have to have this knowledge of this from growing up here, north of here, obviously, but in the States still, and then sourcing all your ingredients from all these different places in the state. You have no choice but to have knowledge of where that's coming from and why it's good and what makes it special and then why it's going to work for you. I mean, is that right to say? I mean, you just have this intense knowledge of this region just because of – you have to use it to feed people.
Right. And I think it's, you know, you can look at it two ways. I mean, you have to be so flexible with how you get everything. And you can either be put off or burdened by the fact that, you know, limes went out of season early this year, which they did. So we don't have limes right now. Or you can kind of celebrate the way that works. Whereas last year we had limes year round. Like, it was just a great year. The lime trees just produced. We never had any slowdown. And, you know, just look back on 2017 as being the best lime year ever.
Yeah.
And just the knowledge of when things come and go and how simple that is and when to celebrate. You know, like we put flounder back on the menu the other day, and it's fun to explain to the staff that flounder leave for a while. You know, November, December, they're starting their migration out into the Gulf, and then early spring, you know, right about now, maybe the last month or so, they're re-entering the bays, and so we're starting to see flounder again.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's only about a 2-3 month gap where you don't see them, but when we tend to serve flounder is in October and then again in the spring.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like there's a seasonality to everything, you know, and I think that's really fun. Or pelagic fish or feral hogs, you know, it's like they're real hard to come by in the summer because we have to get them trapped. And so they don't survive in the traps past 8, 9 a.m. And so nobody traps them. So we start socking away a lot of feral hog late spring, knowing that it's about to get tough. And we serve a lot of those things. So, but I absolutely love it. I love the conversations. And a lot of people don't understand when we say that we're locally sourced, that we go all in. Like, we don't have onions. Well, we don't have onions. We don't have bulb garlic right now. We don't have lemons.
Yeah.
And we don't have limes. I just mentioned. It's more profound, but we just opened a taqueria. And so when we don't have limes at the taqueria, it's a hard conversation sometimes. Can I have a lime with this? Well, we don't have any. And then they're like, well, I saw limes at the store. What's your problem? I'm like, well, it's just not the way we work. You know, yeah. It's just like our food is supposed to be a very acute and direct representative of what's available here. And we don't have to burden anybody else by taking their resources. We don't know what the lime industry in Mexico really is, what the impact is, how they treat their workers, what that land might be better served as. The lime industry here, in South Texas, we know the farmer, we know where those limes are coming from, and we can feel really good supporting them. Sure. And I think that getting beyond this ideal of we deserve to have whatever we want at all times is incorrect.
Yeah. Do you find, you have any good stories about, there's a lot there we can talk, we'll talk about a lot, but it comes to my mind, you have any good stories of relationships with these farmers or growers and people that you really appreciate that have had tough times and you kind of flow with them as they provide you these ingredients? I mean, there's got to be many of those.
You know, I've developed a lot of relationships over the years with farmers. It's definitely changed my ideas about life in general, because they're a certain bunch. They are. They God bless them, but they complain all the time because they have a lot to complain about. They have to deal with the worst of it,
yeah.
Especially when they're doing it right. If they're not, using pesticides, things like that. There really is a lot of pestilence out there that doesn't get reported on these days.
You don't see that in the Heartland Pandering commercials, yeah. Ford commercials. God made a farmer and he's an asshole.
Yeah. I mean, they are, they're definitely the most wonderful people. They're hard people. They have a hard job, and dealing with the ebb and flow of it. And, we've just learned to just accept it, sure. Are you going to have this? Oh yeah, we should have that through July. And then, May might roll around and be like, oh, that was the last of that. That was the last of the garlic. I mean, really? Oh, wish you'd told us that. And then, but they got other things on their minds.
Yeah.
And I understand that. I don't know if I can think of a specific story right now, but, there's a lot of just give and take, but we keep our menus very much in flux,
yeah.
For that reason, and we keep our food really simple also for that reason. So at any point, we're able to take something off or add something on. It's just we like to be really flexible,
yeah.
With it. We celebrate blue crabs when they're in season, and crawfish and oysters and things like that are seasonal seafoods. And then when they're gone, they're just gone, and people pretty accepting of that.
Yeah, I mean, you use a good word there, celebrate. I mean,
yeah.
you're celebrating the seasonality of the place you live.
Yeah.
And I find that, we talked about this before on the podcast about how strange it feels sometimes for me to, walk through the meat section because being a hunter and I'm just eating elk and deer and mm-hmm. turkeys, walking through that meat section now just feels, I feel out of place. It doesn't feel... place I don't visit, I wouldn't know what to look for if I was there.
Right.
If I eat a steak, it's when someone else serves it to me.
Sure.
A beef steak, someone else serves it to me at a restaurant. So there's just this familiarity, and as you well know, the best meal has a story.
Yeah.
And when I've eaten at your place, I was like, there's a story to this. I mean, yeah. It's not written on this paper, but you damn sure know that this all had to come together in some confluence of events for me to eat this thing,
yeah.
Which is a different feeling,
yeah.
For sure.
And it's fun. I mean, it's really what keeps us going. It's hard. I'm not going to try to, garner sympathy, but it is a struggle more so than other restaurants that can just make a phone call and it all appears the next day. Every dish has to be composed one little item at a time, and things change a lot.
Yeah.
When you're again with feral hogs, when you're dealing with those, they can be any size. You might get a 20 pounder, you might get a 120 pounder. One might be lean, one might be a big fatty sow, you might get a big boar. And so you have to be clever in how you aggregate those items to your menu to kind of put it all together so that you do have a modicum of consistency. Because
sure.
If you don't, then, you have to have a little bit. I'm just saying enough. Otherwise, everybody just gets confused. The servers don't know what's going on. Staff just, they can't follow it. But I think that you do have to be able to be just extremely flexible,
yeah.
With it. And I think the celebration, what you're saying, if you eat strawberries year-round, it's not special in March when they come on and they get that first 4 or 5 days of consistent sunlight and they turn into candy. And you just don't, you're not as excited about a strawberry. And you should be excited about a strawberry. You should be very excited about asparagus. It's only in season for about 3 or 4 weeks. And we, to my knowledge, get all of the local asparagus because I've got a guy.
I've got an asparagus
yeah.
guy.
Yeah.
I don't know a lot of people that have asparagus guys, but I feel like that's yeah. You got to have that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's as far as that's all you're going to know, too.
I got this guy.
Yeah.
I meet him in an alley. He gives me a couple duffel bags full of asparagus. Yeah. We go our separate ways. Well, I think it strikes me that all of that, and for me, hunting drove me to garden. It drove me to get chickens. It drove me to do things that I, just because I saw the feeling of eating a backstrap of something I just killed.
Yeah.
If I could do that with other stuff, why wouldn't I? You know, most people don't have the ability to source everything. I mean, it's not tangible, but you can do some things.
Certainly.
You feel like people have, I'd say the other subject is that you teach a lot of people, take them out in the field, non-hunters or hunters, shoot a hog, take them back to your place and teach them how to butcher it up. I think that's also a problem in this country where even for hunters, nobody has a problem coming to your house and be like, can I borrow a deer steak?
Mm-hmm.
Then they go eat the deer steak and they tell somebody, I ate a deer steak. That was awesome. But do they know how to do it?
Right.
You know, do they have that skill? You know, I think that's special all the way around, from knowing where your limes come from to knowing where your garlic comes from to knowing where that meat comes from, and also how to take care of specifically the meat part of it.
Right. And I think education is a key part of it. And with attitudes that are, I'm not going to say changing, let's just say swirling as far as where food comes from,
yeah,
what guns are for, what hunting is. I think that there's kind of a moving line as far as who is doing these things these days. You know, when 8 years ago in Austin, it was a little different. Hunting was definitely perceived to be kind of in the realm of gun culture, and it's since shifted a bit in an appropriate direction. And it's, I love seeing that, or fishing or whatever, you know, like you said, you got chickens, and it's like, once you spend a year eating just fish and venison and eggs from your chickens, it's really hard to go back to buying that at the store, because you notice the way that food sits with you. It's not the same.
Yeah. I was saying before that I apologize to my wife all the time, because I've become sort of a dick when it comes to our finer cuts of meat, like tenderloins and backstraps. If she cooks it up and it's not quite what it should be, or if she leaves it in too long and the baby's crying and she overcooks it, I become a little bit indignant. Like, honey, I can't go get that again.
Right.
And so she said to me a couple weeks ago, you're kind of an asshole when it comes to these nicer cuts that you enjoy so much.
Maybe dial tone it down.
This is a catharsis for me. Yeah. I'm talking to you about it as a way to get it out there in the public so I change.
Right.
But do you ever feel like that at the restaurant? I mean, there is such pressure to use every little bit of everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beet green or, you know, a quail. You know, I think, you know, if you have line cooks that are spent years in other restaurants and they can throw away a part of a chicken, but it's that was a life, you know, and I have no problem with telling them that either. You know, that was a life. You know how I know that was a life is because, you know, and I'm not boasting, but I mean, it's just an observation that I think about all the time. I have taken a lot of lives.
Yes.
A lot. I mean, most of them were bluegills, but, beyond that, I mean, a lot of them were pigs, you know, and it's profound, and you don't throw that away. You give people who are opposed to, you know, eating animals a lot of fodder by mistreating it. One, second, it's just disrespectful to the animal. Yeah. I'm sure, you know, they don't really care if they're getting eaten or prepared well, but it is incumbent on you to do that. And so absolutely it does require a bit of attention. And I think what you were just saying about how the importance that you put on sourcing meat, how it transfers to everything else. And I think that it's very disingenuous. Sometimes when you meet someone that's a hunter and they're very specific, or a rancher for that matter. I see this a lot. They are very persnickety about where their meat comes from, and you open the refrigerator and the vegetables don't have the same provenance. They're not putting the same import in there. And I don't get that. I'm not judging, but I'm just saying I don't understand that. I don't conceptualize
why
that.
Why choose one?
You really have to go all in. And I think that, you know, when you start making these decisions, then resources all around you, no matter what that resource is, if it's a paper bag, all of a sudden you start looking at that a little bit differently. You know, that was a tree. That was an animal. That's an egg that came from a warehouse versus by my backyard. Or I purchased from a farmer at a fair price.
Yeah.
You know, a real price.
And so, you have the propensity to share, too, as I'm sure you're well aware. When that's something that you have, whether it's an egg that you gathered from a chicken that you helped take care of, or a piece of meat from a deer you removed from its body when you killed it, you want to share that with people. Like, that's a more outward communal way to live than it is to just to like, you know, slice up a cucumber and eat it. You had no idea other than it was the nicest looking one in the basket.
Yeah.
At HEB.
I tell people all the time, what do I do with a big boar? I'm like, you turn the whole thing into chorizo and you give it away as Christmas gifts. I mean, that's a win-win right there. You know, you shot the damn thing. You might as well make something out of it. They tend to make excellent spicy sausages.
Yeah.
So why don't you just bag that thing up, make 100 pounds of chorizo, and make a bunch of people happy.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to feel any of the, you know, guilt of not taking it or not knowing what to do with it. Just do the same thing with the whole thing. Cut the back straps. Turn that into chorizo. Whatever. You know, if that's all you can do. But, yeah, gift it.
Yeah.
And I think there is a lot of room for sharing because, I mean, you have that pride. I mean, you know, I can tell you. Let me tell you the story about this. It's amazing. You know, so 180 yards, full run.
Kapow.
Yeah, just rolled it, which never happened to me. But you know, it's I think it's compelling to them too. Yeah. You know, and hopefully that'll get them kickstarted on joining in, because I love bringing new hunters aboard, and also any kind of hunting and fishing with kids. I discovered once I had a kid to be absolutely my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, I. Do you feel like that's part of your, you know, you came up in North Texas, fairly humble upbringings, doing just normal stuff, and your beginning in the culinary world was just the same? You know, didn't you just break in by basically getting a job and learning your way? There was no, you didn't travel to France and go to culinary school. You just kind of figured it out as you went. You feel like your position in that world is too much to share what you're talking about, like this passion and for the food? And I think probably every chef has passion for the food, but this singular passion for not only the food but where it came from and how hard it was for it to get there. I mean, is that I mean, that's obviously not every restaurant in this town doesn't have that idea.
No, and I think, you know, just to that last point, is my real passion is where the food comes from. I have two chefs, Janie and Gabe, who work at the two restaurants that are both better cooks than I am. And I'm very comfortable and happy to say that.
Yeah.
But I know where to get the stuff, and I like teaching them where to get that. And then, you know, the beginnings when you have to kind of work your way up, or when you teach yourself a lot, it definitely makes it more attractive to turn around and try to teach other people. And it also gives you that perspective. Like, I didn't hunt when I was a kid. I fished. I have been a lifetime fisherman.
Yeah.
Hunting, I came to, I don't remember, it was 10 or 11 years ago. So later in life, definitely. Yeah. But I think it's been very positive for me to have that that adult entrance into the hunting world. And then I can understand better adult hunters, like the questions they have and the, you know, the concerns and this and that. And so I think from an empathetic perspective, it's been really good for me.
That's a great word too, empathy. I found that same for me, like talking about hunting, and people just want to be spoken to with in real terms. Like, this is what you're going to experience. I'm not going to give you the bullet points that, you know, these conservation groups or somebody wants to give you. It's not what you learn hunter safety. This damn thing is complex. And I think to the point you're making, it's harder to teach kids that because you can't present them with the entirety of the picture in the beginning. You have to give them like small prism, like, hey, look at this thing, climb up in this box and shoot this thing, and we'll start there, and then we'll get to it eventually. Whereas if somebody who's 35 years old just starts hunting, you can give them the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like, here's all of it. And it's complex, yeah. And it's crazy, and you might cry, you might laugh,
yeah. But
it's going to be crazy. And then for you just to connect the food to it, which a lot of folks don't, even I am very guilty of taking, you know, if I get a deer and I don't have the weekend to process it, take out the good cuts, you know, cut the steaks out of the hams, and take the rest of the butcher, and let them do it. And even then, I feel bad. I'm like, man, I'm...
Well, you're still getting it back.
Yeah, I mean, it's still coming back. It is like if you could, if there was enough time of the day to really have that entire connection, you would.
Yeah.
I would.
But an adult, too, you can go to them, especially from our perspective, and say, what do you want? What is it that you want out of this? Well, I've got a family. I've got five people in my family. I would really like to be able to provide them with meat for the year. I'm like, okay, well, that's going to be a challenge. You know, do you have a place to hunt? Or, I mean, do you have a place to process this? Do you have a freezer? A freezer? I'm like, oh, yeah, you got to get a freezer. things like that. And to be able to go to them and then like, oh, yeah, well, what do your kids eat? Will they eat anything? Will they only eat burgers? I mean, ground or sausage or this or that? And then like, and I think most of them are like, oh, I thought that, you know, you have to do this and that. I'm like, no, you can make this work for you.
Oh, yeah.
You can go in there and totally get out of it what you want and just and have that comfort, you know, because I'll do these classes where we might do a fairly complex butchery sequence, you know, and like, oh, this is how you cut the chops and there's this steak and this roast and that roast. And people be like, well, what do you do? And I'm like, well, grind most of it, make a bunch of it into a breakfast sausage, make hot dogs. And you know, it's very, very simple what I do because that's my needs. You know, my daughter will eat like the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, endlessly.
I've got a lot of buddies that are like that. So yeah. Like,
just
if you want to take the steaks, take them because you and your wife love that. My kid will eat the ground. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, at a lot of levels.
Yeah.
So you're taking how many people a year hunting that have never hunted before or at least have like not a whole lot of experience doing it?
Well, it's our public classes. We do public and we do private. So most of the private classes that everybody's been before, because we're typically being brought to a ranch, and 9 times out of 10, we're dealing with hogs. Mm-hmm. We have a hog problem. We need to know what to do with these hogs. Come out to our ranch for this weekend. We roll out. We cook all the food. We you know show them a few tricks and cleaning them just to make the whole process go a little bit better. We teach them how to butcher, cook, package all that. But the public class is where anybody can sign up, just one person if you want to come along, usually, you know, group about 6-7 people together. You know, we're doing about 3 hunting and 2 fishing a year. We're not doing as many as we used to do, and about half of them are new hunters. So you're looking at about 10 probably new hunters, which is not much, but definitely – the best yeah, experience to sit in the blind with a person when they shoot their first deer or hog and it's on the ground, they get it, and they, you know, they've sealed the deal and they know now how to go about it, you know. And you want to instill confidence, you know. We don't want to hide any of our secrets. We want to give you everything that you need to know to get out there and do it, down to where to hunt, how to get on land, how to talk to a farmer that may have a hog problem to get on that land and help them with it. And nothing fancy, you know, we're not trying to teach people how to do a week long trek in Wyoming for elk. You know, we're talking down home, getting mostly city people out there and connected with a hunt. And these days I'm just really, I stay pretty focused on hogs because it just makes so much sense.
Oh yeah.
You got to pay a lot for a deer lease. But hogs are, you know, a no input invasive, highly destructive animal that's breeding at a rate that, you know, we don't even understand right now. It's going to be bad. We're in like the golden days of the hog problem right now. And so in my mind, teaching people to get out there and source hog and work, you know, work towards at least controlling them a bit is, that's good work.
Oh, it's damn delicious.
That's so good.
People don't understand. I mean, I think they, even javelina to some extent, people see the animal, it's smelly, it rolls in its own shit. I mean, but that's what a domestic hog does the same.
True.
I think an 80, 90-pound boar is, you know, shoot fantastic. One of those. That's some of the best meat you're ever going to get.
It's utterly misunderstood.
Yeah.
And I've heard all the myths. I've heard all the, you know, the tricks and everything in order. Or people just leave them lay because they say they're terrible. And it's the best meat I have ever had has been feral hog. Mm. And, you know, I remember one night we were sitting at the restaurant and we'd just gotten in some whole feral hogs and they just looked beautiful. They were coming off of really good land out in the hill country, and they had a lot of fat on them, but not too much. They were, you know, intermuscular fat, little marbling. And we cut these little steaks off the shoulders, which is my favorite. And we grilled one up and it was profound. I was just sitting there and I called everyone. It was my dinner, but I was calling everybody over and I was like, just try this. And everybody walked up and was like, that's amazing. I've never tasted anything like that. It was so good. And, you know, I'm working on a second book right now that is dedicated only to feral hog.
Wow.
It's the elephant in the room. Everybody wants to know how to deal with them. We used to do venison classes and people would just be like, well, what about a hog? What about a hog? And it's just every class, it's like I felt like I spent half my time talking about pigs.
It seems like the perfect storm, too. It's an animal that they're plentiful. There's no seasons. Mm-hmm. You can hunt them any which way you'd like.
Mm-hmm.
People want you to kill them. Mm-hmm. And they're delicious at almost all levels.
Right.
And why not expand the palate so you can serve almost every purpose imaginable for wildlife? I mean, you're taking an invasive species off the land, and you're eating it, and it's delicious as shit. Like, that is – how's that not the best equation for teaching somebody that?
I would love to have a very civil dialogue with a vegan.
Yeah.
About feral hogs, because my first point is
we can better find one.
They're eating your food.
They're rooting through your fields.
Yes,
man.
Yes. They're polluting your water supply.
We could probably find a vegan pretty quick.
I bet we could go outside and
hold up a sign that says meat.
Swing a Yeti hopper and hit one in the head. I mean, which I don't advocate
politely. They're usually pretty weak. They might fall over, get injured. But yeah, I mean, I think that's what a beautiful way to teach people and what. Like, there's no – I often think if you were to continue to promote, say elk is the most delicious thing and everybody in America suddenly wanted a piece of that meat.
We'd be in trouble.
You'd be in trouble. But not with feral hogs.
Right.
Not with feral hogs. I mean, how many was it? 3 sounders a year? More than that.
You know, probably a little more than around 2. But, I mean, sexual maturity at 5 or 6 months.
Gestation.
Like 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days. And then litter size. You know, you've seen them roll in. The litter can be anywhere from 2 to 12. Yeah. So it's hard to guess. But, I mean, I heard a stat the other day for every 100 people in Texas, there's 10 feral hogs. And that's where we stand, right? That's where we stand today. It's probably 11.
Yeah. As we're talking.
That's, you know,
like national debt. That you could have a ticker. Yeah. That number's going up. Okay. I live right out west of town here, and I had 4 of them in my front yard the other day. And I thought, no way that
absolutely.
Those are hogs. And they were.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate Batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
And I thought I'd get the crossbow out here, go to work if I have to.
Yeah. I mean, I live on the east side. We go on the hike and bike trail and see sign out there. And I thought, there's no way that this is hog sign. And then one of my guides one day said that he saw hogs at that exact same spot on the trail. And sure enough, I mean, you see their tracks.
Crazy.
It is crazy. And it feels good to hunt them. And it's coming down to where that's just my favorite thing to hunt.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. I really like eating them. I respect them a lot too. And it's like, I hate hogs. I want them all. I like to shoot them in the guts and all this. And it's like, you know, they're like, I think humans have this flaw where, you know, like zombies and Nazis are you can kill all you want. Of course, zombies, but whatever. But like, there's this, you get this, once you give this license to be like, oh, well, it's culturally acceptable to just violently kill these things as much as you want. And those are, that pigs fall in that category.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit, I mean, you still have to remember that as a prescient
animal. And that animal has an interesting story of how it got to where it is.
I do believe that we brought him here.
We fucking put him there.
Yeah. Like, so, I mean, it wasn't maybe you, unless you, you know, you can trace your roots back to Spanish conquistadors.
I'm Irish. We were too drunk to pull off that coordination.
Right.
could have never figured that out.
But it is a problem that we brought on ourselves. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, have a bit of respect for
that. Well, and you see that in New Zealand a lot. They have all these feral animals. I mean, feral is the term, non-native mammals they have there. And they get up in a helicopter and fly around, shoot red deer like it's going out of style, or shoot chamois and tar and just throw them in a ditch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those animals are there now. They're part of the landscape. Mm-hmm. You put them there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you didn't, but your grandfather did.
Mm-hmm.
So why not treat them like, even if they're destructive and invasive, why not treat them as part of the landscape and something to go in and manage?
Right.
And as you're well aware, as soon as you take the gloves off, as far as don't respect this animal, we don't care anymore, it starts to be playtime.
Yeah.
And it starts to be like, I can kill it any way I want. I can throw a grenade at it. If I miss, whatever, blow its leg off, doesn't matter. It's just a hog.
Yeah.
Like, man, that like surfaces a lot of the shit that anti-hunters think is down hiding there, that we're trying to be like, wow, we're conservationists, but not really.
Precisely.
Yeah, and so it's hogs have tended to like surface this.
Yeah.
I can do whatever I want now, and I sure do like killing.
Yeah.
And I don't like killing elk. I do like killing these hogs.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute. I feel like that about everything.
Yeah.
And so that's a problem I've had with the jumping a helicopter and, you know, mow them down or.
Right. And I get it as a control, like if your land is completely overrun, which is very common. And I don't, that is not my land, so I'm not there to make that decision, and I'm not judging, but I'm just saying the motivations and the joy taken out of just the wounding, I do have a problem with that.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that every hog needs to be retained in order to feed people, but I don't see anything wrong with making it a goal. You know, it's like if we don't start thinking about these things now, you know, when are we going to? It would be a nice thing. You know, there are people in this state that don't have enough food. There are hogs that are killed from helicopters and they just rot. And I don't have a clear solution for that. But I'm just saying, avoiding the conversation or pretending like oh, it's there's nothing that could be done in that case, I think it's not correct.
Well,
I
mean, like most of those things, it's complicated, but it's not. That doesn't mean we're not going to talk about it,
sure,
and examine it. Like, sure, hey, this is currently, it's kind of like the gloves are off. That's at some level that's okay because that's necessary.
Sure.
But at some level we gotta like make sure we rein that in sometimes. We're like, okay, nighttime tactical hawk hunting is fine, but you need to pile them up in the back of your truck and take them into town, take them to a processor. And give them away, or eat them yourself. Whatever you're gonna do, or shoot them out of a helicopter. That's great, but just have an idea of what's gonna happen at the end of that.
Yeah, it'd be something to strive for. And you know, in that said, also, I would never take a running shot on a deer.
Yeah,
ever. I will take a running shot on a hawk.
100%. Totally agree. I mean, those animals are different. You would treat them differently because of what they are.
Yes.
It's an entangled one. It's one that I always think of, like, it's a cash crop for a lot of outfitters.
Yeah.
You pay people, you know, if it was really that big a problem,
yeah,
dudes wouldn't be taking your money. They'd be like, come on. Yeah. It's costing me money.
I don't know if you got a hog problem if you charge $200 a day, like, to be on your land.
$200. If you see a hog, you can shoot one. You're like, yeah, wait a minute. What are you talking about? I got 20
bullets
right
overrun
here. Yeah, yeah, I got 20 bullets right here. I'm going to shoot 20. That's how that should work.
Yeah.
So I've seen that, how it becomes a bit of a cash crop. Now, that's not totally true all over the place, but some people treat it like, well, I can make a little bit of money off this. Mm-hmm. It is still hunting in its grander sense, so I have to charge somebody for it. If you're doing that, the simple act of doing that, you're already giving up the eradication idea, because that's now it's a commodity. It's not.
You don't want to eradicate a commodity. Yeah,
exactly. And that's right. That's like a weird conundrum with our value system. Like, hunting provides value.
Right.
Holy shit, hunting's now providing value to something that we right. want to eradicate.
Well, look at the scimitar oryx.
Yeah.
You know, it was same. Preserved through hunting. You know, people, you know, got all up in arms because they thought we're going to kill all of them, but hunters don't want to kill all of them. They want to keep them around. Yeah. And so the complicating factor with hogs is, you know, the state agencies want them all gone. And so to monetize them in any way through hunting and so forth is detrimental to their efforts. And I know a couple of states, I can't name them, but they have outlawed recreational hog hunting. And as an experiment to see what happens if you 100% demonetize the hunting of hogs to see if that affects their population.
I think you and I know what the answer to that is.
It's not going
to work. It's not going to. Ranchers aren't just going to all of a sudden give that up. And I mean, I've never paid down a hog, but every time I see one, I'm like, it's an exciting experience. Like, there's a hog. I'm going to shoot that. I'm going to eat that.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that.
Oh, I see ribs.
Yeah. I see a whole hog. I'm like, I see a 50-pound hog. I don't see, like, oh, cute little fella. I see that's a whole hog. I can put on my Traeger. I can close that thing, covered in bacon, ironically covered in bacon. Go back in the house and come back and it's delicious. Like, that's what I see.
Yeah.
And I think if other folks would see that, and I'll be interested being a Texan what you think about javelina, because I start, now that I shot and ate a few javelina, I think the same thing about them. When I see one, I'm like, dinner, boom.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's limitations on those, though.
Two,
I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Two a year.
And I mean, as game animal, and not as prolific. And, you know, like I said, it's like all of my hunting efforts are pretty much, I mean, I go to the deer store once a year and like, I just want to knock down some big does as fast as I can. If I saw a 14-point buck walk out, I'd take a picture of it and show it to somebody that cares and be like, I saw him over there.
That thing costs a lot of money to somebody.
If you're interested, he might be there, but I am not. I don't care. You know, shoot a few does, shoot a few ducks. And beyond that, it's gotten down to being hogs for me.
Yeah. And that's great. That's I look forward to reading that book, because there's a lot that I think people need to know, one, about the history of the animal, and two, about like where it stands now and where it stands to go in the future, because it certainly is an entangled, and Texas is like the flag, way for
we're going to set the standard here, you know, in control. And it's such an interesting environment because, you know, 97-98% privately owned state has, it's helped the hogs quite a bit, because there's these vast ranches and these hogs have huge areas where they can go, huge sanctuaries that they can be untouched and breed. Yeah. And then they're fed corn. Almost year-round in a lot of places, too. So, you know, the problem is exacerbated by the almost cultural climate of Texas.
Yeah.
So, I find it very fascinating, and I really want to be able to delve into it. And I think that this project that we're working on, you know, we're trying to approach, you know, cooking them in a way where kind of empower people to look at their individual hog and be like, oh, I can get this and that out of them, instead of treating each hog as the same animal, because, you know, 30-pound pig is not the same as a 200-pound boar.
Yeah, and I had a Texas rancher tell me not too long ago that any hog over 150 pounds, he throws in a ditch.
Yeah. Oh, I was
like, dude, that's
one.
More meat. Yeah. Like you said, I probably aren't going to cut the back straps out and cook them that night.
No.
But I'll figure something out.
But you know those 149 pounders? Succulent.
Succulent.
You know.
160 I mean, pounds of ruins it.
No. No way. No way.
Can't have it. Can't have. But that's, you know, and same with javelinas. This guy's like, well, them old skunk pigs, mm-hmm. can't eat those. I'm like, they stink. I'm like, well, yeah, they stink. So do hogs. But you just peel off those glands and they're above their hip, and they taste as good as anything I've ever tasted.
Yeah. You know? Audad. You know, we've been told, you know, when we were on a ranch, we worked on a ranch for about 5 years for our public classes, and last 2 years they allowed us to take some audad, and, you know, my favorite conversations. Oh, you know, hey, you ever had audad? No. I've heard it's inedible. Did you try it? No. Okay, good.
I shot one down in Del
Rio. Not a scientist, are you?
Yeah. Not a theorist either. Yeah. I shot one down in Del Rio, and the cook was Mexican, and he would not let me in. They said, well, we don't cook that here. I'm like, well, you kill it here. We cook it here. They said, well, the cook doesn't allow it in his kitchen. Like, not even. I said, I'll cook it. They said, he doesn't allow the meat anywhere near his kitchen. That's how. And they were, at some level, an all-dead outfitter. So I cooked it up over the open fire, and it was terrible. Because I didn't really care at that point. But I talked to him, and he said, oh, they stink, they smell, they're nasty animals, face of animals. Like, that doesn't mean all dead can't be good.
No, it's true. I mean, but, you know, people tend to also shoot the biggest male.
Yeah, which I did. It was like an old ram, too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. Do you feel, people like yourself that are, you know, really in it for the culinary aspects and in it for the wild food, I always ask, do you feel like unburdened by not having to worry about what's on top of an animal's head? I mean, they're
absolutely.
You feel like you're getting it right somehow, or other people got it wrong.
I really don't care what other people do, and you know, if they're really into that, then I support that. Yeah. I think that's wonderful. You know, but personally, well, you know, this last year, we do a deer hunt, me and three of my friends, and it's our freezer filler. We go out and we shoot deer, we get it all together, process it, and we divide it amongst four families. In years past, we've always hit it perfectly when the does are really active, and it's in South Texas, and the does are typically just huge and beautiful and super tasty. This year, the deer had already bachelored up when we went down there. We went down there about 2 weeks later than we normally do, and we ended up just shooting mostly spikes. And I just really noticed the difference in the meat. You know, and I miss my does, you know, I mean, I like my ladies and
I like a big lady, big run.
And it's just, it's not the same. And to me, that's what it's all about, you know, and I, of course I enjoy hunting. I love it. But I enjoy, you know, at the end of the day, when the four of us come back and we've got four or five, maybe six does on the ground. And that's like, that's a good day.
Oh man. When I was a kid, skinning parties, like, hunting was great. Killing an animal was always a big event. But just four or five guys in a garage with two deer strung up was the best part of it for me. I look forward to that more than anything.
Yeah. I love it, too. You know, and just, you know, peeking under there, seeing how much fat they've got, seeing how good your shot was. And just looking forward to that deer. But, yeah, no, you know, I love, you know, listening to, like, Stephen Ranella are reading his books and stuff like that. But it's, and I think this is really interesting, is I'm not that kind of hunter at all. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and we are very much on the same page in that, well, I'll back up. He went out the other day to a local creek right after a rain. He nailed three big channel catfish. He drove 20 minutes from his house. He went out there. He got those channel cats. He brought them home. His family is rabid for catfish. I love catfish too.
Wow.
I mean, and he was telling me this, and I was like, dude, you fucking nailed it. Like that is it right there to me. And to me and him, and we really see eye to eye. Some people want to fly to Alaska. I don't. I want to travel the shortest distance to get myself dinner from my own region. And I just think that there's like, I think that's where all the romance is. And luckily everybody else is, you know, wants to travel. But
oh man, romance is such a good word.
But I, you know, I was hunting pigs. I had a little spot about 20, 25 minutes from where we're sitting. Mm. And I had a lot of pigs up there. And we managed to kill two out of there. And it's, I mean, we're talking right outside the suburbs. Totally legal, by the way. I got checked by the sheriff one day. And he said I was cool.
City limits and all.
Yeah, that was scary. Anyway, to me, that is the best. To be able to, like, you know, drive out there, shoot a pig, get it in the cooler, take a shower, and be sitting down for dinner at 8 p.m.
Yeah,
that's really what I want, you know. And it's not this not this long, torturous hunt. But, I mean, I see the beauty in that. But really, I am mostly in it for the food. Yeah. And the more efficient I can be about that, the more excited I get.
It's funny that I see, you know, we talk to people that do it for all these different reasons. And there's some people that I know that do it for that personal experience, that arduous journey, the bettering mm-hmm. of self, and like the
it's
animal.
Wonderful.
Yeah, the animal at the end is great. The meat at the end is great, but they wouldn't. None of that would be as special if there was this like journey, this hard journey that was all about perspective and challenge. And
sure,
that kind of thing. That's awesome.
Oh, well, I'm glad there's a spectrum of people that
and
why so, they do.
Yeah, somebody like yourself would be like, I'd rather not mess with that. I'd love to go catch a catfish. That's just as beautiful, and I think the romance for a place that is right in front of you is a little bit more intense than the romance for a place that's far away.
Right.
And I think that's key to what you're talking about. I mean, like you can, your kids can understand because of that catfish, what it means when it rains, what it means when the spring bloom starts, what these trees mean, what those trees mean, what that owl hoot means, what that turkey gobble means. Like that is, I have a small son and I walk outside and I can't wait to tell him all like how all this is connected to who he is and what he does as a human. And you can't, I mean, you can come back and talk about a caribou, but you sure can't show him one.
Right. Right.
Unless it's Christmas time or something.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's really profound. And that's, you know, that's why I love it. You know, I got to go on a grouse hunt in Idaho and it was amazing. And, you know, I really loved it, but you know, I would have been just as happy catching, you know, some crappie, you know, 45 minutes northeast of here.
Yeah.
It would have been
absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, that people, I think we tend to add value to more beautiful animals. We tend to add value to elk.
Certainly.
And I think we probably also add value regionally to animals that are more plentiful, you know, turkeys and deer and such. But for me, when I think about like what's the most regal animal, I'm like, oh man, the wild sheep.
Yeah.
Like I've seen like a few wild sheep out in nature before. And I think why not have the same respect or the same admiration for a catfish?
Absolutely.
That lives where you live and does, you know, basically is a part of your daily existence. Whereas this sheep, there's very little I can do to affect that sheep's life and vice versa.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what you're touching on is exactly that. Like you can reach in that water and touch that catfish whenever you feel like it.
Yeah. If you're good.
If you're good at noodling.
Yeah, yeah.
In that sense, you feel like when you're teaching, when you're taking somebody through a hog they just killed and they're cutting the meat out and they're dissecting it, you feel like that romance is there during the process? They're feeling that as they're doing it, or is it just like
you know,
paint by numbers at that point?
No, they're in it. And I think it's the most fun part of my job is, well, you know, the hunt. I mean, I think that's where the real adrenaline build happens, you know. And I remember I do a parks and wildlife hunt. I guide and I'll cook dinner and then do a little class the next day out at Inks Lake, which is really fun. State park around here. They close off for hunting. And so it's, I don't know, there's something really exciting about going to a state park that's closed for hunting. And so it's, you feel like you're getting to pick all that forbidden
fruit. You step over the rope and you're like, look at it.
Yeah. Like the deer that were on the playground, you know, and all of a sudden, but it's available to new hunters and it's to expose them. And, it's, you know, being able to sit with them when they shoot their first deer. And man, I don't know. I mean, my heart is just racing when I see that deer walk out and you're like, oh, that is your deer. I know it. That's your deer. And I'm like, take your time. And I'm just trying to be cool because if I'm not cool, that guy is not going to be cool. So I love it. I really, really love it. And then in the cleaning, when they touch it for the first time and they realize it's hot, not cold, you know, and like, yeah. There's all these little steps that they got to take, and then the guts, and it's like, oh, it's a little stinky. Yeah, but it'll get better here in a second. We'll be fine. And then, you know, kind of work through it. And then you show them all the different cuts and what you can do with it and how to, you know, get the most out of it. And, you know, again, have that conversation. It's like, what do you want? Well, I don't know. And like, what do you like to eat? You have a blank slate in front of you. If you like sausage, man, you just hit the jackpot. So, you know, all those things. And no, I there's such a tangible excitement with new hunters, and also teaching lifelong hunters how to cut and do things a little better. Oh, I never knew you could take the rib meat off of a deer and make anything worthwhile. I'm like, absolutely, you can.
Because, I think as a hunter, even somebody who hunts all the time, you learn that in little pieces. You don't learn it in one sitting. You're like, oh, this is kind of cool. I'll do this one time. Yeah. Well, that worked. I'll do that next time. That's how I've
still learning. Still learning. Absolutely. And every animal's a little different. And you just, you know, it always changes. And I love that. And I'm always, you know, I'll try this out with that, you know, see if that's good. Sometimes it works. Sometimes it doesn't.
That's the beauty of it.
It is the beauty of it. And, but it's yours.
Yeah. Food-wise, is there anything that, you know, there's a lot of people out there that shoot a deer, specifically deer, I'd say, venison. Is there any tips that you've learned that are foolproof that you just think people need to know? Because I'm interested in that. Like, as I cut up an elk or cut up a deer, is there something that's universal that you've seen that always works and that people never do?
You know, I think there's, yes, there is. And I think that specifically with venison is people battle silver skin too much. Silver skin is collagen. It's going to melt into gelatin if it's cooked at a consistent, you know, pretty relatively low temperature, you know, like 190 or over for a long period of time. Let's say 3, 4, 5 hours. So all those pieces on the deer, like the shanks, the neck, things like that, that have a lot of silver in them, use those to your advantage. Just cut those off in big pieces and slow cook those. Don't try to bone them out and then clean all the silver off. You're wasting your time. And also what you're doing is you're undermining the base fact that silver skin has a quality, that quality being gelatin, gelatin being a richness, also nutrition. So take those shanks and those neck pieces and just cut those into big chunks and slow cook those, and then let the meat fall off the bone instead of trying to go in there and meticulously trim all that silver out so you can get it through your grinder. There's other cuts on that animal, namely the hams, the shoulders, that are going to be way easier to put in the grinder. And in fact, you can just throw them right in if you have a powerful grinder. You don't really need to even worry about cleaning them up at all. So what we've done there is not only are you getting more nutrition or in flavor out of that animal, but you're also doing a lot less work. It's kind of this lazy approach, but I feel that people get frustrated. Like, it takes so much time to trim all the silver out. And I'm like, I spend 0 minutes trimming silver.
Do you leave it on back straps?
No, absolutely got to take it off there.
You're fast cooking it?
Yeah, exactly. Time to break exactly. Down. Any muscle that doesn't get worked a lot, like your back strap, your tenderloin, has to be cooked quickly, obviously. That silver can go into stock. You know, of course, if you're not dealing with chronic wasting disease, there's the big asterisk right there.
Forever,
you can take that silver and all the bones and make stock out of it. That silver skin will convert again into gelatin in your stock. And so there is zero waste coming off that animal. Yeah, clean up the back strap really well. But those legs, basically, when I say shank, I mean from the elbow to the wrist or from the knee to the ankle.
A lot of guys, the shank's becoming, I mean, guys like Remy Warren, Steve Rinella, I mean, that's what, the shanks are one of the first things they're looking at. Shanks and tongues.
Tongues, yeah. It's great. You know, these cuts, these off cuts, they're so good. And I've always, on venison, I've always been a big fan of the belly or the flank meat, the belly on the, you know, taking it off
the ribs
and the
there.
the whole rib section, cut that off. At worst, you can take it and grind it into a really beautiful stew or chili meat, but it needs to be cooked for a long time because it contains a lot of silver skin. It won't make a good burger, but diced or ground, it's going to make excellent chili because, as I was saying earlier, over time, that collagen breaks down into gelatin and it becomes, it's a textural thing and it has a really nice flavor. So you can take that and make a whole bunch of different things. In my first book, In a Field, we roll sausage and egg and breadcrumbs around, or we roll the belly around that and then braise it for a very long time. And a very long time, 6 hours, you know, crock pot, low oven with lots of tomatoes, you know, lots of acid. And then you can come in and slice it and it's perfectly tender. And people I tried to cook that before and it was tough. It's like, it didn't break down. You know, these are wild animals. Their legs have to break down. You know, prime example would be the breast of a turkey versus the legs of a turkey. You know, how often do turkeys run? How often do turkeys fly? That's how long you got to cook each one of those, conversely.
So I wish there was a rule. It'd be like, how long do you think this thing flew a day? That's how long you got to cook it. And I cut the legs and thighs off every turkey I killed. In fact, I just killed one in Florida a couple of weeks ago. And I ate one breast, delicious, got that down. Don't need any help with that, but legs and thighs. Like, what the hell do I do?
You've got to cook them for a very long time.
You like, braise them? And
braise
then,
them. They need to be, I would say, close to submerged in a liquid. A crock pot is going to serve you really well, and any kind of acid is also going to serve you well too, be it tomato would be a classic. Just you could sear the leg off and throw it into a crock pot with stock, onions, celery, carrots, whatever you want to put in there, tomato, maybe a little wine if you want to, and then you're going to cook that until it's tender. How long? I don't know how old your turkey was. I don't know how hot your crock pot is. So it will get tender, I promise you that. But, I mean, it's going to be a very long time. It could be 7 hours. I tend to just go overnight with that stuff or before work. And that's the beauty of a crock pot is because you don't have an open flame. And so you can just put stuff in there and let it go. But a lot of complaints about the tougher cuts of game are they are tough. And if they're tough, it's because they first off weren't cooked in a moist enough environment. And secondly, they weren't cooked for long enough to actually break down. That collagen has to break down.
Reverse sear? Yes, no?
Sure. I'm an old dog. You know, I see pictures online all the time of successful reverse sears. I'm a traditionalist. It's kind of like shooting big deer. I don't care what you do. I'm just going to cook. This is so easy for me to do it this way. So, you know, I might eventually come around to it. But for now, I love, you know, a venison backstrap is just goes into a marinade of olive oil, salt and pepper. And then it goes onto an extremely hot grill. And it's
try to get it to like
seared hard on three sides. I feel like a backstrap has three sides. It has a slight triangle to it. And I like the sear the most, you know, so medium rare, maybe a little bit north of that, you know, pushing medium is fine with me. I tend to like meats a little more cooked than rare or medium rare.
So you throw it on there and you ever oven it or smoke it at all?
Just no,
all you cast need iron, to. Boom, boom, boom.
Cast iron or a grill.
Or a grill.
You know, just like a very hot charcoal fire that is ripping hot.
What's the best way to get that crust that everybody's always after? Because I've had some steaks where guys like, it's got that awesome crust, but it tastes like pepper and salt.
So oil. Oil. So there's no fat in that. You're going to get more of that, like I said, that marinade of olive oil. And not a lot. I mean, just rub it with olive oil, but that's really going to help it. You know, with smaller game animals, like if I was to grill a quail or a dove, I usually am going to incorporate something sweet in there to expedite that caramelization process. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of honey in with the oil will help that char on the outside before the interior is overcooked. And so just adding a little bit of that in there. Typically with the backstrap, it's thick enough where you can get, and if your fire is hot enough, you can get a good enough sear on all three sides. before the inside is ever cooked, and so you don't need that kind of that honey crutch.
Yeah. So then you rest for
as long as you want.
As long as you want.
Yeah, like minimum that. 10 minutes. But mm-hmm. I mean, I think that food is great at room temperature. So you know, 10-15 minutes, it will become pretty tender if you let it, you know, sit for 15 minutes, and then slices against the grain, and then
just medallion type.
Yeah. Yeah, whatever perfect. You do beyond that is up to you.
That's beautiful. I'm pretty hungry now.
Yeah.
After that. Yeah. Is there any other – I was trying to think of all the questions I have. These are mostly my questions, so I'm sorry, everybody listening. You'll have to deal with what I freaking want to know. Ribs.
Yeah.
Like, how do you – say you know, in this local environment, you shoot a deer, you have a full rack of ribs
yeah.
to deal with.
Okay.
It's a good-sized deer. It's healthy. Yeah. You want the rib meat.
Yeah.
You're taking it on the bone, I assume.
You're talking a standard rack of ribs.
Standard rack of deer, okay. Venison ribs. I always just go back to deer because that's the...
Sure.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
This is what I do. And it's good. And it's, you know, I don't know, it's 2018. You're going to piss off somebody no matter what you do.
We're here to piss off.
Everybody. Is there a comment section to this?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I can't wait.
Give it to him. Give him to it. I've already said all types of dumb shit already, so don't worry about that.
I've already
set the threshold.
I've already whacked a vegan in the head with a Yeti hopper. So here I go.
That's good product placement.
And I'm going to tell somebody to boil ribs.
Holy shit.
I didn't say boil. I did say boil, but that's what the comment section, that's what the comment outrage is going to say. I'm going to simmer those ribs until they're tender. And it's the reverse sear is what it is.
We're back. You're so trendy now.
It is.
Now you're starting to.
It's crazy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take those ribs and I'm going to take a very highly seasoned, water. You know, I'm going to put some bay leaves. I'm going to put some salt, some garlic, ginger, whatever you want to put in there. It's again, free country. So, and I'm going to cook those ribs at a simmer, not a boil, until they are tender. Not falling apart tender, but just tender. And then I'm going to pull them out and I'm going to cool them a little bit. I'm going to taste a little bit. And if it's if it's seasoned enough, I'm not going to season them anymore. If it needs a little salt and pepper, I'm going to salt and pepper them, and then I'm going to get, again, a ripping hot fire. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're doing a mixed grill, a little backstrap, a little bit of ribs. Great, because you just need one fire on there now. And I'm going to take a 50-50 mix of vinegar and honey. Whatever vinegar you want to use is fine. I prefer, you know, an apple cider vinegar is going to be really good. I'm going to take those ribs, and I am going to brush them with that, and I'm going to put them on the grill and flip and flip and baste and baste and baste until they get a crust. And so what I've done with the initial cook is I've got them tender, and then with the secondary cook, I've added a little bit of smoke. I've added some char. I've added some sour, and I've added some sweet. And the reason that you can't go all the way on the smoker with those venison ribs is they just don't have the fat really to self-baste when they're breaking down. But I mean, in order not to just throw them away, this is a really good method. You could also pre-cook them and then 3 days later, throw them on the grill. Gotcha. You can cook them in your stock pot and then pull them out and then, you know, use, you know, get secondary nutrition out of those bones in the form of the venison stock. There's all kinds of things you can do with it. But for ribs, that's what I do. A hog ribs is a case by case. If they've got enough fat, you can do a traditional just straight up smoke on them. If they're super lean, revert to the pre-cook.
Pre-cook. We'll call it pre-cook for this conversation. Yeah. Yeah. Take it back to, there's a dead deer on the ground, skinned it, its guts are out. How do I go about getting these ribs off in a way that makes sense and is quick and clean and I'm not snapping bones all over the place?
Cleaver and a mallet. You got to get the cleaver and mallet, very, very basic. Once you get the hang of it, you can take down any animal with a boning knife, a cleaver and a mallet pretty much. You know, get rid of the saw and the dust instead, you know, a nice sharp cleaver. I love a old hickory carbon steel $25 cleaver, my favorite. And then just a rubber mallet from a hardware store, preferably locally owned.
Locally sourced wood, rubber.
Yeah. So, all right. So, I think the cleaver and mallet, you just tap, tap, tap right through those ribs. You can use a saw. Saws get a little funky in there. But yeah, it's the best way to get them off. And on a deer, I never cut chops off a deer. I always take cleaned backstrap. There's too much connective tissue in that chop. That's, I think, I, the backstrap is superior.
There's been some buddies of mine, they'll go unnamed. His name's John Dudley, who posted something through Traeger with chop, like backstrap chop with the bone still in them.
Now, you can definitely do it.
Is that legit? I mean, that's going to make it.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just find there to be a bit too much connective tissue in there compared to that pure, I mean, a really well cleaned backstrap on the grill. I kind of prefer that experience over it. But again, it's free country.
Free country. We are in Texas.
Yeah. Extra free.
It's extra free here.
Yeah.
Are there any, I don't know why I was thinking about this when we were talking earlier. Are there anything that frustrate you that you want to talk about? Just not in.
How much time we got left?
Let's go. You said you got to pick your kid up at 5.
Yeah.
Sometime.
No.
Are there any things like in the hunting and the culinary world, because this is a hunting podcast, is there anything that frustrates you that you feel like that?
You know, sometimes I feel like, you know, I read a lot of forums on hunting. I never ever post on there, and I don't feel like my opinion is that valid, but I kind of dislike when people say, as we're a hunting community, we all have to be unified on this. And it's like, there's no community in the world that has to be completely unified on anything.
Yeah.
You know, we all don't have to be of the same mind. I don't have to shoot a coyote. I don't want to. Well, I have a terrible coyote problem on my land. I'm going to shoot coyotes. Okay, I get that. You know, I understand that. But I don't want to shoot one. And I'm never going to. So, you know, we don't have to be unified. We can have these differences of opinion, and you can do as you wish on your land and things like that. You know, I wish that, you know, I understand as hunters right now, there is kind of a call for unity because certain aspects might be considered to be under attack. But at the same time, I mean, we have to have kind of a spectrum of ideals, in order to be, you know, plausible.
And that will always be true. Hunting will always be under attack as long as it's, I mean, maybe there was a time in our society where it wasn't, but like modern sport hunting is almost always been on attack for the, say it's been around for 90 years. It's been under attack the entire 90 years. And it's only intensifying because of urbanization, things like that. But your point is well taken. And there's a lot of people in our industry that are big names that are calling for this you know, out-and-out unity. Like, look, I get what you're saying. I get the idea of what you're saying. But that's that idea of this you know, this unity that has to be in perpetuity, that's more dangerous than a bunch of smart free thinkers with the same goal coming together, be like, how we figure this thing out.
Correct.
Super complicated. It's complex.
Yeah, I think it's very complex. I think just, you know, of course I'll respect other people's opinions and it's legal. And I'm sure there are many cases where you need to shoot that coyote.
Oh, yeah.
But you're going to have to do that.
Well, Ranella, he's made the best. If I could come up with a better analogy, he's like, look, if we're all in a boat and somebody's in there shooting holes in it, you're not going to be like, well, we're all in the boat together. We got to let him keep shooting holes in it. No, right. You push him over the edge. Like, you just say, if you please walk the plank, we would like to plug the holes up for you to get out.
Right.
And so that's a harsh, you know, I feel like I would never tell everybody to, like, kick out people that do something they don't agree with, but I think it would be much better if we all codified a little bit of, like, what are the barriers with which hunting exists. And then try to, if we can better define those, then we don't have to so worry about all our conversations being in this weird gray area where you don't agree, you know, high fence being the perfect example of that. Like, you live in Texas. High fences are everywhere. I just drove here from Houston. That's all you see. You know, Black Buck Ranch. It's a freaking high fence.
Yeah, yeah. I know that 3,000. Yeah, I mean, I've never been on it. But
it's delicious.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, as a Texan, you have, well, as a pretty, by now you've been here long enough that you could say that you're a Texan.
You could tell me I'm not Texan because I'm from North Texas or something. I'm like, I've been called a Yankee.
Wait a minute, son.
Because I was from North Fort Worth.
The Mason-Dixon line is a little bit further north than North Texas.
Yes.
that's not the intent.
Sorry, I didn't mean to derail. Go ahead.
No, I just think that how we define that matters. And how we define, like, if high fence is, it could save the scimitar horned oryx in some way. That's important for that animal. But is it hunting now? Like, is it just game farming, which is okay because you run a restaurant. You can't just buy, you know, Billy Bob's deer from down the street. It's got to come from an approved game farm. Is that right?
I mean, not to make that muddy that water, but ours comes, they're trapped, and so they tend to come either from a cull on them, typically a high fence ranch, or escapees that are trapped.
Yeah.
I think that they are definitely a couple steps more wild than a farm, most definitely, as in respect to the venison that we get in, the black buck, the sika, red deer, elk, things like that. Non-native, and I like to think of them as invasive, you know. Yeah. Same thing goes for the feral hogs, they're trapped. That's a great point. The way I think about it is just like we're kind of dealing with our situation, and high fences exist. I think the jury's out as to the long-term effects of what sequestering groups of wildlife can do. I think chronic wasting disease might illuminate that a little bit more, because that might be how it gets here. And but at the same time, you know, we live in a place that's got a lot of wild land, and it's because people steward it through private ownership. And that's a great thing in my mind. And so if you've put a high fence around it, then maybe that's gonna, you know, just work in your benefit towards stewarding that land. There's a lot of argument, and I really don't know. And again, it just boils down to, you know, I just do what you want to do on your land.
Yeah, I mean, that's this is America. Like, yeah. I would never be like, let's regulate high fence. Like, you want to have high fence ranches, perfect. Yeah. Go for it. If somebody wants to come there and shoot one of those animals and do whatever they want with, hang on their wall, or I'm almost, I'm fine with that. But I think where we as hunters should probably draw the line is like, look, it's not hunting per se. Like, just call it something different. Don't try to, you know, like there's an elk on the wall in front of us. If that elk was killed in a high fence and I came over and you were like, how'd you kill that elk? And you said, well, you know what? I went out, it's early in the morning, crawled up a hill, there he was and I shot him and there he is on my wall. You're like, well, that's a misrepresentation of hunting. Like that's mm-hmm. you taking the easy route and then trying to represent the hard route that I took or you took, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's using the aspect of the trophy to signify something that's false. So that concept is wrong. So what do you do? Not let that person hang it on the wall or make him put a plaque underneath it, like a
disclaimer.
High yeah. I mean, you can't regulate it. There's no way.
Put an ear tag in it.
Yeah. But that's it. It's got to have an ear tag around the head of the animal.
Yeah.
But so I don't know how you would regulate that.
Yeah. And that said, you know, we've got some clients that bring us down for a class or two a year. And they're high fenced, and it's 25,000 acres. It's massive.
It's massive.
And you know, they're usually on the last day. You know, we're all done, and they're like, "Hey, you want to go kill a hog?" And I'm like, "I got my pants on, right?" And so,
is that going to be the title of your next book?
I got my pants on.
I got my pants on, Volume 2.
And I've gone out there, and I think I've sat four or five times, and I've never killed a pig. They just gave me the slip, and they're always confounded by that. They're like, you're telling me you didn't see a pig? I'm like, I swear I didn't see a pig. I saw a horse with antlers on it, that's for sure.
I saw
the biggest deer I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, and I've hunted turkeys on high fence places where like a zebra scared away the bird that was coming. we hunted 2 years ago. We hunted a place that had tigers and eland in the front yard. Tigers, of course, in the cage, eland not. But, I mean, I was calling a bird in and looking up, and there's like a tiger walking on the skyline.
That's so strange.
Only in Texas. Yeah. Only in Texas. But, yeah, I think that this culture is it's one, it's not indicative of the rest of the country. I mean, it's the culture down here is I would say, unique. It's not strange. It's just unique,
mm-hmm.
you know, both because of the way the land is treated, the privatization of all this land, 99% of this giant state is private. And then the fact that there's a whole culture around putting fences up around it, and what that means and why, like you said, I'd be more interested in reading about what it does to the landscape,
mm-hmm.
whether it improves surely doesn't improve the biodiversity of a place if you fence it off.
Right.
And just putting a bunch of invasive species in there, so just the off chance they don't get out is even more dangerous because they often do get out.
Right.
You know, hence you can drive an hour west of here and shoot an axis deer on the Llano River.
Yeah.
A free-ranging one.
Speaking of, if anybody out there listening has access to Axis,
Axis.
Please contact me. I have a prejudice against those things.
I can probably make that happen
so
for you.
So good.
Oh, my gosh. We're getting ready to go.
So good.
3 weeks, we're going to Lanai in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
I killed three of them things last year, and I'm out of the meat already. One here and two in Hawaii last year, so I'm on Team Axis. The fact that there's not a whole lot of, just as somebody who doesn't own any land or doesn't have a lease around here, there's not a whole lot of positives for Texas and hunting. It's kind of just a non sequitur, but Axis deer, the fact that I can drive and beg a landowner to shoot an Axis deer an hour away from where we're sitting right now is one of the more fantastic developments ever.
Yes.
The history of eating meat.
And invasive. And so, you know, I have to weigh that against the whitetail, you know, which we need to definitely cull their population. But then, you know, a couple factors are going to put Axis ahead of that. And that is how good they are to eat and the fact that they're invasive and highly competitive with that same whitetail.
Right.
So at the end of the day, it's like, you know, we might have a conversation in 5 years, and at that point, I'm only going to be hunting axis and hogs. And yeah. I'd be fine with that.
That'd be a fantastic way to live.
That would be.
If you're at home, you're like, honey, we got.
Oh.
All we got.
That's all we got.
All we got is axis and hog. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And my wife, she buys chicken here every now and then, and it frustrates me. And she's like, I just want white meat. I can't eat red meat all the time. And so this year, I've shot one turkey, but my goal is to shoot 12, if I can get 12. I got to travel around to get that done or beg, borrow, and steal to get 12. But I feel like if I can kill 12 turkeys, then we've got our white meat for the year.
Yeah.
That's what I kind of figured. If one turkey lasts a month, mm-hmm. two breasts, two legs, whatever. Legs and thighs being more difficult, maybe less now that you gave me some tips. But that was my other goal. I was like, can I make lunch meat out of turkey breasts, freeze them, and make mm-hmm. lunch meat later? That would be – and so
– brine it, smoke it, slice it.
Beautiful, easy. I've done – yeah, I do that with the honey glaze and just – it's one of my favorite things in the world. But that is – if you – the other great thing about living in Texas, you can shoot four turkeys a year.
Yeah.
And if you don't like to eat white meat a lot, that would last you 6-8 months if you do it right.
Yeah, I'm going to try to shoot two this weekend.
Me too. Yeah. I'll let you know right. how it goes. Yeah, I'm going to shoot four come in. I'm shooting four. And that's how I feel. And oh, I don't. Yeah. Last year I did a lot of hunting with a bow for turkeys because I was just really into archery. And I still am. But now that I'm on this mission to feed the family, shotgun.
Yeah.
Like a full on. I'm not trying to tickle them anymore. Like
I don't need the handicap. I
shoot them in the
270
face.
And a shotgun, a 12 gauge, just does everything for me.
You never had any problems with that? Not the lethality of a 270 versus an arrow, like 300 feet per second.
Last turkey I got with that 270, I got to say, I put a really good shot on it. I lost zero meat on that thing.
Yes. Yeah. No. That was one of the few times that I love bow hunting, and I do it almost exclusively. But I was like, what am I doing? I can use a shotgun. I really love to eat these things.
Mm-hmm.
Why be less effective? What am I doing?
Right.
And that was last year around this time when I realized, hey, I got to go with the shotgun. Mm-hmm. I got to go. And the guy we're hunting with this weekend, my buddy Brennan, owns Archery Country here in town.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I'm sorry, but I'm coming with a shotgun. Archery Country or not, I'm just going to shoot every longbeard I can get my hands on. 2 years old, 3 years old, I don't really – So that's the beauty of it. Like, I can have that with turkeys. I don't know if I could give that to myself with elk anymore just because I'm too far down the what's on top of its head game. But I could do it with turkeys.
Yeah.
Because who the hell cares? Like, what's one less feather in the fan going to bother me?
Right.
What about the beard?
Fried turkey?
Oh, boy. Oof. How do you fry in a turkey?
I just cut this is so redneck, but I mean, just cut it into strips and probably brine it, throw it in a little buttermilk for, you know, a few hours, you know, maybe up to like 12 hours, let it kind of tenderize a little bit and then just bread it.
Just buttermilk?
Fry it. Yeah. Buttermilk and hot sauce if you want. Add a little more acid in there. Then just dredge it in flour and deep fry it. Now, I mean, the pro tip would be deep fry it in pure beef fat. And then
holy
you're
hell.
Really going to be happy about that.
You're changing lives.
Yeah.
We're going to post this at lunchtime. Post this right around 11:30.
Yeah.
Really get the viewers coming in.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been really fun.
If you haven't read or if you don't own a field, you ought to own it. It's fantastic. I mean, you wouldn't need another. It's not a cookbook. What would you call it? Coffee table book.
Coffee table
meat
book.
People.
Yeah.
Meat eaters coffee table book.
Yeah.
Because it really is that. I mean, it's not just recipes. It's not just butchering. It's every little piece of knowledge you'd want to have.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. You know, I appreciate that.
Well, I can't wait for volume two. And then if you're in Austin, come to Die Dewey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other than that, appreciate it, man.
Absolutely.
All right, brother.
Thank you.
Yeah. And that's it. Episode number 9 in the books. Thank you so much to Mr. Jesse Griffiths for sitting down with me in Austin, Texas to talk about all the things that we covered. It really was a great conversation, and I hopefully you'll be able to bookmark this one when you're hungry and you're looking for a good recipe or some good tips and tricks on how to cook your turkey breast or turkey legs or turkey thighs or venison backstraps or venison ribs. Hopefully that is a great takeaway from this one, but also just how important it is to source your food, not only your meat, but your vegetables and your eggs and anything you can, either locally or from local farmers, or farm it your damn self if you can. I think that's something I will strive to do, and I hope everybody that can does. As always, you can go to thehuntingcollective.com to check out more from this interview and others. Last week we had Sam Soholt and we had Charles Post. A couple of great conversations with great dudes. So hopefully you can check out episode number 7 and 8 respectively. But there's also Ryan Callahan, Steve Rinella, John Dudley, Shane Mahoney, Aubrey Marcus, and more. Don't forget Remy Warren, my boy. All that's there at thehuntingcollective.com. It's all there on iTunes. It's all there on Stitcher.
we'll soon be adding Google Play to the mix and even more to get you more avenues to listen to this thing. But that's it. That's all there is for this week, episode number 9. Next week, we'll be in the double digits with episode number 10. Got a really good guest lined up for the next one, I believe. Don't want to let it out of the bag just yet. And then a couple other really good guests. And the following week, we'll be at the BHA Rendezvous in Boise, Idaho. I'll be hanging out there Thursday all day and part of the day Friday. I got to bounce out early. Unfortunately, won't be able to hang the whole weekend. But I hope to see some of you there. And I'll be podcasting with some of the industry's best during those couple of days. So thanks for tuning in one more time. HuntingCollective.com, at BennyOB301 on Instagram. Come check us out. And until next time, see ya.
Hey, if you guys like to cook outdoors, and you oughta, you should check out the Weber Slate Rust Resistant Griddle. So this is a carbon steel cooktop that's safe for metal tools. It's pre-seasoned with food-safe oils and ready to cook on right out of the box. It's the griddle that stays ready, not rusty. This griddle heats evenly edge to edge, reaching all the way up to 500 degrees. Get fired up for your new Weber Slate rust-resistant griddle. You ever get that feeling? The walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide-open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.